Rates ran up, covenants got tight, and a lot of sponsors found out the hard way that time does kill deals. Today, we're sitting down with attorney Richard Crouch, 2 decades in the trenches of commercial real estate law, to map the exact moves that keep you out of full recourse and in control of your deal. We're going to be talking about servicer standoffs, capital call politics, and subtle ways that lenders turn technical defaults into leverage. I'm Kevin Bupp, and this is the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. It's the show where we strip away the headlines and we talk directly with operators, investors, and experts shaping the next cycle of commercial real estate. In this conversation, you're going to learn how to approach a servicer without triggering extra fees. We're going to discuss what to communicate to your investors before you skip a distribution and why buying the note sometimes beats rescuing the equity. Plus, we'll hit the recourse landmines that most sponsors overlook. Things such as guarantor death clauses, unauthorized transfers, and bad boy triggers hiding right in plain sight. Richard Crouch is a veteran CRE attorney specializing in workouts, restructurings, and complex finance disputes. His clients include lenders, developers, and family office sponsors navigating today's tightening credit cycle. So let's dive in.
You know, maybe to kick this off, maybe to share a little bit, you know, for those that aren't familiar with you, that, you know, maybe haven't heard you on a show or, you know, haven't worked with you, take a few minutes and just give us a little bit more of a background of you and how you became the, I guess, the go-to legal advisor in the commercial real estate world.
The vast majority of the legal work that I do is basically structuring commercial real estate transactions, from basically business formation for the entity that most investors use, analyzing loan documents, title, and all the other nuances that are part of that process. I actually was very lucky. Very first firm that I worked for is the one I still work for, but for one merger, but we're still, the folks I see every day are the ones that I've been seeing for about 24 years. So very, very happy with where I am. And I think a big part of that was I had two excellent mentors. One was very skilled in the technical aspects of commercial real estate, what to look for, what you should never miss when reviewing documents and structuring deals. And the other mentor I had was great at teaching me everything they never taught you in law school. Everything to exactly. Running law as a business and keeping your clients happy and not wasting your clients' time. He was excellent at that, and as well as instilling the mindset that time kills deals. And so you need to always be adding value for your client. And that's one of those things where we're very fortunate when we have good mentors, because it's been 24 years and I still use what they've taught me every day. Very fortunate in that regard. During the time of practicing with them, and I should say now that the latter mentor is no longer practicing law. He's actually teaching yoga in South Beach and doing Russian acrobatics. And
interesting transition.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He could work for Cirque du Soleil with his various pursuits and hobbies and everything else. So he's living the good life, but definitely left a good legacy behind. Yes. During basically the scope of my practice, there's really nothing that we don't handle if it touches on real estate. So it's not only forming the businesses and all of the aspects of due diligence and running it through closing, but also the more nuanced areas like historic tax credits and 1031s and qualified opportunity zones too. So lucky to be surrounded with good practitioners that can supplement all those areas.
Yeah, fantastic. And congrats on just a long tenure, 24 years. That's very rare nowadays to stick with one employer for that long. So congratulations. I think that was very commonplace, probably like our parents' generation or our grandparents' generation, right? It was kind of odd if you didn't hop around every 3 or 4 years. I think that's just kind of the norm now. So again, congrats there. Just obviously speaks to your employer and just your thorough enjoyment and satisfaction of being employed there. So that's fantastic.
It's surreal to think that I now have a team of my own, young attorneys that I'm helping shape. And I think my mentors find it mildly amusing that a lot of what they had to endure in training me, I now get to do with my young folks, but all the valuable things, are part of their legacy as well. So that I'm passing on. So
So you have 24 years now. You've been through a couple of cycles, a couple of, of down cycles, a couple of up and down cycles, I guess you could say. Then, you know, ultimately your mentor, I don't know, you know, how old they were, but I'm sure they're, you know, a couple more decades of experience that they brought to the equation, which also encompassed a number of other cycles. And so in one form or fashion or another, you've seen, or you've somewhat lived or learned about the various cycles in the marketplace. And, you know, we've had the last 3 years have been somewhat volatile in the marketplace, interest rates rising at a unprecedented pace. You know, we've found ourselves in a higher than anticipated interest rate market for much longer than anticipated. Not sure exactly what that looks like over the coming years, but I guess, you know, as a result of all that, and then other, even as a result of COVID, you know, threw a couple wrenches in the equation, there's a lot of stress. You know, there's lots of loans that are challenged right now in multiple different asset classes. You know, office was already having some problems going into COVID. COVID just, I think, was the somewhat of a nail in the coffin for some of the more functionally obsolete, less in offices or the less desirable, you know, B and C class offices. And so, you know, we find ourselves in a time where there's a lot going on, both good and bad. And so I guess what I'd love to do today is maybe focus on the, you know, the turbulent side and, you know, you working with clients, maybe on the sponsor side or maybe even on the buyer side, right, that are out there looking for opportunity. And so I guess let's kick it off here. You know, what's the first thing, you know, speaking from a sponsor's perspective, if you're advising your client who's a real estate sponsor, what's the first thing that you would advise to them when deals start falling apart, when they find themselves in a situation? Now, obviously, that could mean a multitude of things. Maybe it's one of the loan covenants was breached. Maybe they're delinquent on a payment, you know, taxes are past due, whatever it might be. But what are, you know, what advice do you give clients that are in that predicament?
I think the key thing that I constantly impart to them is the need for constant communication and transparency. And that can be with the servicer of the loan, but in particular with your investors, because when you do get in a troublesome situation like that, it doesn't take long before your investors start asking questions saying, hey, it's been a quarter or more since we've gotten any of our returns, what's going on? And you really need to be ahead of it in terms of if you're suffering from cash flow, if you're having trouble maybe accessing a reserve for tenant improvements that's having an effect on the performance of the property, you need to, or if you're having trouble maybe meeting debt service covenants, you need to tell your investors, number one, what's going on, and two, what's your plan for that. And one thing that's very relevant is dealing with a lot of servicers. They're not known for expedited service and responsiveness. And so even sometimes if there is no update to give, you need to give that particular update that you've reached out to them numerous times, memorialize everything in writing, and basically keep your investors in the loop. Now, if you're having to basically do some sort of workout or maybe an extension of a loan, a modification of a loan, transparency is very important in that regard as well. The one thing that I would be very cautious about, but make sure you revisit the loan documents, revisit any, if you have a carve out guarantee that basically lists those events that might trigger full recourse, to really scrub through that and make sure that even if it was accidental, that as a borrower or the principal of a borrower, you haven't possibly breached those. One thing that can come up, and never assume the servicer has your best interests at heart either. One common thing we are seeing is if there is going to be an alleged default by the servicer, right now they are using it as an opportunity for a cash grab to basically say, and they'll make it seem like they're doing you a favor because they'll say, oh, we think there was a default since this point in time, interest that would have accrued from that point, that particular default has accrued in the amount of X number of dollars, and we may waive it if you either do credit enhancements or something else to basically situate the lender better going forward. So one thing that comes up is sometimes people have done a transfer, not necessarily to a third party of the property itself, but they maybe did some transfers between members. Or maybe even did some transfers for estate planning purposes, like put something in a trust. that maybe was not allowed by the loan documents. And some of these CMBS loans, an unauthorized transfer without the lender's approval can actually be a full recourse event. So that's, you know, any and all damages alleged by the lender, an individual can be subject to. And it's one of those things where they may have done it completely accidentally, not realizing that that was something that was not permissible. Some of the other things that I think are maybe lesser offenses that I'm hearing servicers try to hang their hats on is if there are financial reporting requirements, maybe by a guarantor or by the borrower, if those submissions are incomplete or they're late. Sometimes servicers will try to allege a default there and try to gain leverage there. And one other thing that's coming up, particularly if you have a lot of maybe older baby boomers or more seasoned investors that were guarantors on the loan. Sometimes if, depending on how the loan's structured, sometimes the death of a guarantor is an event of default.
Wow.
And hopefully you have language saying that you have maybe 60 to 120 days to proffer a substitute guarantor. We usually try to negotiate that in there so that you're not just left high and dry through an unanticipated event. But sometimes if you do have a guarantor pass away and you haven't either notified the lender in a timely way, or you haven't submitted some of the requested financial reports, in that event, you know, for the estate or for one of the trusts, that also can trigger defaults in a lot of these loan documents. Now, a lot of these loan documents I'm talking about are the more sophisticated loans, that you'll see, but I think you'll find in just about every set of loan documents, whether it's CMBS or a conventional bank loan, the death of a guarantor itself is a pretty common event of default. So that's definitely something where you want to at least have that period of time to try to substitute a guarantor.
Real quick, I wanted to share something before we move on. If you follow me for a while, you know that Sunrise Capital, my real estate investment company, invests in mobile home parks and parking facilities. Now, our current fund is closing out this calendar year, 2025, by acquiring six already performing assets worth about $50 million in total. And these assets will spin off cash flow and continue to grow in value for years to come. Now, I'll highlight that 2025 investors will also get K-1 passive losses from bonus depreciation up to 100% of their invested capital. Now, put simply, if you invest $100,000, you're going to get up to $100,000 in passive losses in this calendar year, 2025. So if you're looking for income, growth, and significant depreciation for this calendar year, find out more by going to investwithsunrise.com. Thanks for your attention. Now let's get back to the interview.
Yeah, I'm thinking through the, you know, scenarios where that could, you know, create challenges. I'm thinking of, you know, larger agency loans where sometimes you'll find there's multiple key principals that are signing on loan docs, some that are just, you know, silent partners that aren't involved in the day-to-day operations. And sometimes that might not communicate on a regular basis with the primary sponsors, right? In the event that happens, you've got one of your KPs that passes away and it triggers a loan default. Again, just thinking through hypothetical situations. And then, you know, I'd be curious to know from your perspective, you know, we try to steer clear of CMBS loans. We've done a number of them over the years. Yeah, obviously, the very, very convoluted and lengthy loan docs, it really takes an expert that has a knowledge and experience to comb through those and really understand exactly the structure of that given loan and any of the, you know, I guess the gotchas in there. And so do you see that as an area where borrowers get into that type of loan that they really don't fully understand the entirety of the loan documents and again, some of those gotchas that might be buried in there?
I think that's very true. One thing that we have done for clients, and we've developed it over time, but the very first thing when we do a review letter of loan documents, the very first thing we'll summarize for them is what are your events of default, and particularly what are your carve-out events where you could have unlimited liability. And so that's one of those things where if you can distill it and simplify it, because it's not uncommon that a loan agreement can be 100 pages long. Yeah. And in most cases, unless they have a lot of free time, they're not reading it. And so if you can basically simplify the process for them. And there are other things in that review letter too, like what's your ability to access reserves? How complicated is it? Mm-hmm. You know, how exactly is the debt service measured in terms of quarter to quarter and you know, just to limit any sort of arbitrary allegations of default by the lender. And then just having things like, you know, rights to cure defaults as well, before the lender tries to enforce all of its remedies. And one thing that I forgot to mention, not so much in the loan documents, but that's very important to include in your operating agreement with your various members, investors, is to have a very clear provision as to additional capital, or if you have to do a capital call, what are the mechanisms for that? Because we're seeing that a lot right now as well. And I remember when I was a young attorney, we had some syndicators where it was very important to investors that there be a provision that there was no capital call in any event ever, which can really hamstring a syndicator. So fortunately, right now, everything we have, every operating agreement has provisions for when a capital call can occur, any sort of information that the syndicator needs to provide as well, because it's one of those things where it's not uncommon that a lot of money has to be put in to save a troubled asset. And you want to make sure that that process goes about as smoothly as it can. And usually the reason I bring it up while we were talking about loan documents is usually that process is going to go hand in hand with any sort of loan extension or loan modification you're doing, because on a simultaneous path, you're having to raise additional capital as well to make it all work. So that's been something in the past couple of years that we've had to revisit several times, particularly for syndicators in office. And it's very comforting to know that there is language that addresses the situation, what the steps are for it, and how it's going to interplay with the loan modification as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to know that you said years past that, you know, the LPs really were against, you know, putting that type of language in there. Surely no one ever wants a capital call. Being an investor in the deal, you don't ever want to receive that email or that call that, you know, it's in trouble and it needs to be an infusion of capital. But it's also the difference of that deal probably making it or not, right? It actually, you know, ending up back in the bank's hands. So no, it's interesting, and I'm personally involved in some deals today that where I'm just the passive investor, where they've had capital calls, and you know, that's another interesting process to go through. Especially, I guess there's different classifications of limited partners out there. Some that are just don't really have any real estate sophistication. They might be incredibly successful in their practice or their business. Obviously, high net earners or high income earners, but ultimately don't have a lot of practical experience with real estate. And so, you know, it's going through the navigating the process of making the determination of, is this just throwing good money after bad? Should I actually participate in this capital call, or should I just chalk this up as like, this might be a loss, right? And I just might need to write off this money in my mind and know that that's the better decision to make. I think that's incredibly challenging for a lot of LPs that are out there today, and a lot that have been involved in one or multiple deals that are in various forms of distress. So any thoughts there of how to best navigate that if you're a, you know, passive investor and you're in a deal and a capital call comes about, and how to help make the decision whether or not it makes sense to put more money into it?
Yeah, ideally you have language that addresses this in some form or fashion, but in terms of some of the concepts that have been helpful is when you have a situation like that, having some path forward where the sponsor or the syndicator can basically say, this is why we're deficient. This is what's contributing to it. This is how we're going to improve it. And to have a pretty clearly laid out plan for the various steps that are going to be involved and why putting in additional money is a far better option than simply foregoing your initial capital. We do have provisions like that in our operating agreements. And sometimes if you don't have it in your operating agreement, if there's a good relationship, good communication between the syndicator and their investors, you can paper it at that time. Obviously, it's much more ideal to have it laid out ahead of time. But we'll actually have provisions that remove some of the murkiness in terms of the performance, that make it clear that with certain objective events, like you haven't met a return for two consecutive quarters, what the steps are for basically alleviating concerns of your investors in terms of submitting that business plan, and what are some of the objective criteria for performance. And all of these things are designed to basically facilitate and the basically the syndicator to continue to communicate and not to play ostrich when things go sideways.
Yeah. And I guess in your experience recently, how receptive, you know, back to the lenders thing, how receptive have you seen lenders today in workout discussions, you know, talking about modifications or maturity extensions? Have in your opinion, have they been fairly receptive up until this point? And the second part of that is, do you see that changing at any point?
Yeah, ultimately, they will work through it in most cases. We have not been finding that they're eager to try to get the assets back. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that is going to change specifically, but in most cases, they're mainly leveraging it as an opportunity to charge a fee maybe get an additional principal pay down as well in connection with that, even if it's a relatively short extension, like 6 months to a year. Some of the payments of interest or just the workout fee are still incredibly substantial to basically keep the asset alive. But it's, I guess the short answer is yes, they'll cooperate, but in most cases, borrowers are having to pay for it in some form or fashion. I think some of the two will also depend on the degree of the default. If it's one of these things where maybe it's still, there's exposure, but maybe it's not full recourse liability, they might be willing to work with you a little bit more. But we have had some cases where we have had to get litigation counsel involved because the servicer was not being responsive and was not being reasonable and was acting like they were pretty much unassailable. And there are some firms that specialize in that as well. And you may start to see more and more advertisements for basically litigation against servicers that are not being cooperative or kind of taking advantage.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that's a function of maybe some lenders that were more, you know, had the mentality of, you know, loan to own, you know, like they actually are okay with going through with a default and they do want the asset back? Or is it just a disorganized loan servicer and they just don't have a great line of communication and it's very difficult to get in contact with them?
I think it tends to be more of the latter, maybe coupled with the desire to improve their books, improve their fees, and so on. It will always be guised under protecting, because so many of these are securitized. It'll always be guised under that being the rationale. But sometimes you can very clearly see through what's working behind the scenes. But we haven't found, although it may come up in discussions, that they wouldn't mind owning the asset. We haven't really found that that's been the driving force in terms of really seriously wanting to have an imminent foreclosure.
Mm-hmm. Do you see there being any opportunity on the flip side of this, for buyers that are out there, not necessarily buying, distressed, the actual real estate itself, but buying distressed notes? Have you had any clients that have managed negotiations in a transaction with buying a note that's in distress from a bank or a lender?
We do have some clients that are interested in doing basically distressed funds to basically try to do that. We've had some who have structured it with all of the paperwork of basically buying the note and being prepared to foreclose. So I think as time goes on, there probably will be more and more opportunities like that, because there are a lot of syndicators who came in at a time that the market was very good and you almost couldn't lose at the time. But now that they're really starting to run into a lot of hurdles, in many cases, it's going to be easier for them to try to get the keys back. Yeah. I think we probably will start to see more and more distressed funds and people who are purchasing notes and trying to obtain property that way.
Have you seen quite a bit of activity in your practice as relates to either, you know, clients being buyers or sellers in the office world? I mean, I know that your resume, you've got a number of office, larger office transactions you've been involved in. I don't know what time frame that was, if that was of recent or of years past, but just curious there what you're seeing.
I would say in the last 2 years or so, most of the acquisitions in that sector are more of your owner-occupied scenarios, which are easier to finance, and they're not as focused on satisfying investors' returns. There's more of a self-interested component to it, because sometimes it may be one of those where their business is going to be run through that location, and it's just more of a long-term play that you're seeing. But those are pretty much most of the acquisitions we're seeing, particularly in that sector. The only other exceptions might be if somebody is having a timing crunch with a 1031 and they're needing to find a replacement property. We're seeing that as well, but definitely have been a slowdown in a lot of the traditional syndications. And that's actually in most sectors, because it's just with rates where they are, it's just hard satisfying those turns and making the numbers work.
Yeah. Yeah. How about as we wrap this up here, if you had just one piece of, you know, you can't give legal advice per se, but any advice to sponsors in today's market, and more specifically around just really helping them, you know, protect the downside and mitigating any future risk, and just really stay nimble and again, somewhat of a volatile environment. Any advice you'd have there?
To the extent you're able to, I think maintaining reserves, and sometimes that'll be lender driven anyway, but making sure that you have enough in reserves to weather difficult times on future products and have conservative underwriting, I think that would definitely be very helpful. Mm-hmm. Discounting the importance of memorializing the deal on the front end. And I know I've touched on it a lot with operating agreements and so on, but also with your initial investor materials, so your subscription agreements, your investor questionnaires, your operating agreements and PPMs. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you're very forthright and not to belabor transparency, but if there are fees that you're going to be charging, make sure everything is itemized and very clearly specified so that you're not having to explain it later. But also make sure that you definitely have that disclaimer language. And that's, you know, very important, where, because you may not have super sophisticated investors like you were mentioning. They may be accredited, but they may not necessarily meet the sophisticated criteria and maybe don't know a whole lot about real estate investments. But you need to have that disclaimer language saying you could lose your entire initial capital from this project. You know, we're hoping it does well. These are our projections, but again, you could lose it all. So I think that's very important. And I think the other thing, and this, you know, this really could apply to any business, but to not be afraid to admit what you don't know and to build a good team and surround yourself by good advisors. It's a relief sometimes when we work with clients that are honest about that, saying, hey, I'm a little bit out of my wheelhouse here. What's difficult is sometimes dealing with clients that double down when they're in an unfamiliar territory, and being so provincial in that regard, and maybe even a little bit proud in that regard, sometimes contributes to a worse situation for them than if they had simply had good advisors at the time. And that could be an attorney, that could be a CPA, it could be a structural engineer on down the line. But it's good to not be afraid to make mistakes, because that's how you learn, but to definitely surround yourself with experts and people that are maybe smarter than yourself. You know, it's kind of one of those things. That's kind of what a lot of folks that have been successful will oftentimes tell you, that that's one of the keys to their success.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just being self-aware and being honest with yourself of, like, you know, where do I thrive? You know, what am I the best at? And then what am I mediocre at? Where I'm mediocre, you know, again, make that list. And ultimately, you surround yourself with others that are this excellent in those particular areas. So, and, you know, to your point, surrounding yourself with folks that are much smarter than you. So, no, that's great insights, great feedback, Richard. Appreciate you coming to the show here. For those that want to, you know, reach out to you, get in contact with you, where's the best place to track you down?
Sure. There are two ways are pretty effective. My email address is just richard.crouch, and my last name is like Crouching Tiger, C-R-O-U-C-H, @woodsrogers.com. And both Woods and Rogers are plural. And my mobile phone, which may shock you, I'm giving out, but I will get the message and I will get back to you, is 757-353-0969.
You're a brave soul for putting that out there. But guys, we'll put it in the show notes.
All right.
Well, Richard, no, I appreciate you coming to the show. Thanks for joining us here today.
Certainly, certainly. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, that's all we have for this week's show. So until we meet again next week, this is your host, Kevin Buff, wishing you huge success. Take care now.